Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Anthony Bourdain took his own life in June 2018. More than 3 years later, he is still missed. His memoir, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, marked a turning point in his life and had a big impact on those who read it. Then Tony invented a new way of telling stories about food and travel for television. Writer and editor Lori Wolever spent nearly a decade helping Tony and co-authoring his books. She has published a book called Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography, and it truly is the definitive book about Bourdain. Lori interviewed almost 100 of Tony's closest friends, family, and co-workers who were part of the Bourdainverse. She joins us now to talk about the legacy he left, the many hats he wore, and how the two of them became co-workers and friends.
I actually first met Tony in 2002. He hired me to help out recipe editing and testing for Anthony Bourdain's Layal cookbook, which was his first cookbook, and it was something that came up after he published Kitchen Confidential. So that first meeting, I had already read Kitchen Confidential, like everyone else in New York and in the country. So I had a specific idea of what I thought Tony would be like, you know, brash and funny and outspoken and very, a big personality. And the person that I met that day was actually much more reserved and quiet, kind of shy and almost socially awkward. We had a pretty quick meeting with his other chef and the owner of the restaurant. And it was just, it was not what at all what I expected, but he was lovely. He was much more kind of ground level than I expected. And that really was the case throughout my time knowing and working with him.
Tony published Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly in 2000, and it became a New York Times bestseller. Why was this book so successful?
I think there are a number of reasons. I think first and foremost, Tony had such a distinctive and really charismatic and engaging writing voice. You know, it was funny, it was sharp, it brought in a lot of cultural and historical references. It was deeply personal. In as much as he skewered other people, he was also very willing to skewer himself and lay bare his own faults and bad decisions, often to hilarious effect.
I took it in my hand, tilted the shell back into my mouth as instructed by the now beaming Monsieur Saint-Jure, and with one bite and a slurp, wolfed it down. It tasted of seawater, of brine and flesh, and somehow of the future. Everything was different now, everything. I'd not only survived, I'd enjoyed. This, I knew, was the magic I had until now been only dimly and spitefully aware of. I was hooked.
So there was that. And then also, I think the subject matter came at just the right time. This was a time in food writing and food media where things were very buttoned up. And all of the magazine articles and everything really focused on high-end luxury and really just the surface of things. And Tony was the first in his era to really pull back the layers and say, this is what really goes on. And this is the truth about the entire business, not just what you see on the plate or what you see at the front door, but really the whole thing. And people love to be told the truth and to really know the secrets of what goes on behind the facade.
Very well said. Tony told his editor, Karen Rinaldi, that if he ever did TV, that would be a big sellout. So how did he end up doing television?
Well, I think he saw television as part of this grab at the brass ring, and this gets addressed in the book. You know, he understood that if he wanted to keep being successful, if he wanted to figure out a way to make money and make a living and not have to go back into the kitchen, that he would have to expand his profile beyond making books. It's very satisfying to write a book, but I'll tell you, it is not a path to financial success unless you are a Stephen King or a James Patterson or, you know, one of a handful of writers. But I think he understood that if he wanted to keep this thing going, he was going to have to do television.
Mm-hmm. Anderson Cooper told you that, quote, finding your voice as a writer is one thing, making that into television is a completely other thing, unquote. How did Tony make that transition?
Well, I think he had the right partners. He started out and all the way through his career, he worked with Lydia Tenaglia and Chris Collins, who were his partners at 0.0 Production. And they were just, when they first started out, they were just two people making sort of freelance television, and they built their work with Tony into a full company. So they recognized right away that Tony had such a singular voice, and they were really champions of him getting to keep that voice and getting to refine it for television. You know, they were not willing to compromise and try and shoehorn Tony into, you know, what a network probably would have wanted from him, which is barbecue rodeo in a parking lot. You know, they really wanted to make sure that his voice, which was the thing that broke him out into the world, that was maintained as much as possible.
First thing you encounter when you visit Tsukiji is big. It's really big. It's really spread out. And the choreography has to be seen to be believed. There's a system here. Everybody seems to know the moves except me.
And then, you know, he had to fight on his own too. There's a section in the book where different people talk about his very strongly worded, hilarious, and lacerating emails that he would write to editors, producers, directors, to network executives. I mean, he felt so strongly about the purity of his vision that he was willing to burn it all down.
Right. He was very much a perfectionist. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, with the understanding that nothing is ever truly perfect. As a writer, I think he always knew that there was a little bit more that he could have done. And I think this is a very common thing. David Simon talks about it in the book, that even if you know that you've done your best, you always know that there was a little more. There was something you didn't quite achieve on the page, no matter how well received it is.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of David Simon, that was something I didn't know until I read your book and read the quotes from David Simon, that Tony actually wrote scripts or partial scripts or scenes or helped with scenes about that take place in the restaurant for Tremé, right?
That's right. He was so thrilled. I remember when he got the news that he was going to be a staff writer for Tremé, and he said, "This is an absolute high water mark for my career. This is, I cannot think of a better thing for me to do than to be writing on a David Simon series." He was so thrilled. And so they brought him in for at least two, if not three seasons, to write the restaurant storyline. And he was so good at it.
If we're going to be true to what we believe.
Excuse me. This is how the Creole fairy folk back home cure their 3-day stubble.
I told you. Sazerac. They gotta be kidding. Nobody throws a Sazerac.
David and Eric Overmeyer and Lolis Eli all talk about being in the writer's room with Tony and, you know, how quick he was to turn scenes around. And he brought all of that knowledge from being a cook and a chef for almost 30 years into those scenes and just really lent an air of authenticity to all of the restaurant stuff that went on Tremé.
In 2013, Tony launched Parts Unknown on CNN, and this really seemed to be the ultimate TV show for Tony. It really showed off his talents. What was he doing differently on Parts Unknown that made it work so well?
Well, I think there was an increased seriousness in some ways. Now, of course, there was still plenty of humor. There were still plenty of episodes where it wasn't that serious. You know, they went to Lyon, France, really just to dig into the deep, beautiful food culture there. And there was very little about politics or any of that. But there were plenty of shows where they were able to use the resources of CNN, the security, the worldwide renown of a news organization like CNN. They were able to use those things to get deeper than they might have with the other cable networks that he was involved in the past. So he was able to tell the kinds of stories that he really wanted to tell.
Eating something out of a bowl that I'm not exactly sure what it is. Scooters going by. So delicious. I feel like an animal. Where have you been all my life? Fellow travelers, this is what you want. This is what you need. This is the path to true happiness and wisdom.
It made, I think, more people willing to talk and willing to open up, knowing that this wasn't a cable travel show, that this was some pastiche of hard news and storytelling and documentary filmmaking. Tony wanted for years to go to the Congo, and they just couldn't, when he was with Travel, they just couldn't quite get the right insurance and the right security and the right sense that they could go and successfully tell a story and get out. And so it was only with CNN that he was able to finally realize that dream of it. And things got dicey at some points.
The Congo is a place I've dreamed of visiting since before I ever thought I'd get the chance to travel the world. Actually being here, I'm not so sure.
You know, so I think CNN really just gave him the confidence and the structure to go deeper.
When was the last time you saw Anthony Bourdain?
The last time I saw him in person was in New York in about mid-May of 2018. It was a few weeks before he left to go to Alsace, which is where he died. We met in the voiceover studio that he used to do television. It was a Friday morning, probably mid-May, and he was ecstatic. He was, at that point, just about to leave for Florence, where they shot an episode of Parts Unknown that never ended up making it into an episode because it was just too raw and painful. But they spent a lot of time in the Uffizi Gallery examining and discussing art, and it would have been an amazing episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just a few weeks later, in early June 2018, Tony hanged himself in his hotel room in France. Why do you think he took his life?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? As I said earlier in the conversation, he was someone who lived life always, you know, at 11 or at 1,000%, right? So one thing that had really taken more and more of his time and energy was a romantic relationship that he was in for the last 2 years of his life. And this gets quite a bit of time in the book, the observations of the people around him, that it had become an obsession and something that he was pouring all of his energy into a lot of times at the expense of everything else in his life. So there were some trouble in his relationship in that last week before he died. So I think the short answer is he had a spasm of grief, loneliness, of, you know, extreme heartbreak, disappointment, and that led him to make a really terrible decision to end his own life.
What did you think of Morgan Neville's documentary about Tony, Roadrunner?
I thought it was brilliant. I will disclose that I was a consulting producer on the film, so I'm not an impartial party to this, but I am not myself a filmmaker, and I really was really pleased with the work that the filmmakers did, especially considering that they never got a chance to meet Tony in person. There was such an extraordinarily treasure trove of footage from all of these television shows and this beautiful documentary footage that was shot about 20 years ago or more that never got made into a film. But I really loved the way that they were able to use that and kind of weave that into modern day interviews. I know there was some controversy around a small bit of AI that was used in the film to recreate Tony's voice. And I bring it up only because I think it was such a, it did such a disservice to the film that became the dominant narrative during the opening theatrical release weekend. And I just felt that it was really unfortunate and really unfair to the filmmakers that, our internet tendency to pile on without all the facts really sort of overshadowed what was, to me, a brilliant and beautiful film. And for 40, I think fewer than 45 seconds worth of AI in a 2-hour film that was full of Tony's actual voice, I just thought people were really missing the story if they were clutching their pearls over a bit of technology.
Mm-hmm. And because in all fairness, they were Tony's words, the outrage was that he never recorded them. What do you think Tony Bourdain's legacy is?
Oh, I think it's a huge legacy. You know, I think that he certainly made the restaurant industry very, very attractive to a lot of people who might have otherwise gone into different careers. I'm sure he's responsible for any number of very, well-educated, well-rounded people kind of tossing it all aside to go be a line cook or a chef or a maitre d', for good and bad. I mean, I think it probably really energized the industry at a time when it was starting to feel that it needed a shot in the arm. I think he's also probably encouraged a lot of people to look at whatever it is in their lives, whatever their careers are, whatever their story is, and see something worth telling, and see that if you just tell the truth in an engaging way, that could be something that somebody else wants to read. And then, of course, I think he has encouraged people to travel in a different way, to be very, a little bit more open, a little bit more mindful, a little bit more interested in not just the major tourist attractions of a place, but to spend time looking at, you know, what do regular people who live here, what do they eat? What's the street food? What's the cafe? And what are the conditions of people's lives, I think, in a way that wasn't really part of the conversation 20 or 25 years ago. Now people are wondering, are people making enough money? Do the people who live here get enough to eat? You know, what is the, how does the government play into how people are living and what they're eating? So I think he had an enormous impact on the culture.
Lori Williver, thank you very much for joining us today and for the great conversation. Congratulations on Bourdain, the definitive oral biography, and also on your podcast, Carb Face.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Lori Williver is the author of Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. You can find out more about Lori and Tony Bourdain at wpr.org/beta.
You know, one of the great things about being a writer is that in my work, I can experience all kinds of other lives.
Alex Olin joins us to talk about her short story collection, We Want What We Want. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.